I see some faces that I didn't see yesterday, a few, and in honor of those faces, I will introduce myself again. I'm Paul Bauermeister. I'm on the faculty at Seminex. I also have a practice as a psychologist. This is my wife, Jeanette. She's an administrator at Seminex. That's enough of an introduction. Let me just, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, very quickly touch a couple highlights of what we went through yesterday. Yesterday we said a family is a balancing act. That's an effort to say that the key word in terms of family living is interdependence. And if you can set that down for a minute, I'll show you all what interdependence is. It is a balancing act. When two people get married, they're best off if they try to establish an interdependence that looks like this. We put our toes together and lean back. We're getting good at this. You can be rather comfortable this way. You can have some fun this way. Whoa.
Not too much.
Not too much. And when other people are added to this family, they should become a part of the interdependence as well. That means they hook onto this somehow or another and exert their pull and be a part of what's going on, and that way they can join the fun too. One of the difficulties with an interdependent family is that whenever you add or subtract people or change people, there's likely to be a disruption to the interdependence. Things get rocky. So, several key words. Interdependence is one, change is another. And that's kind of where we left it yesterday. Now I'd like to pick up again. The title for today is Keeping Your Balancing Act Together. And what we're going to talk about is commonly called communication. And to start it all off in the Bible, we'll go back to Genesis again, chapter 11, and a funny little story that's just kind of chung in there in the middle of a whole bunch of other stuff in Genesis. If you don't believe me, take a look at Genesis sometime. That's really how it is. We're going on, and we have Noah and his sons and a long genealogy, and tells about where everybody went. That's chapter 10 in Genesis. And then comes chapter 11, just kind of out of the blue with this funny story. It's a story you know. And it lasts for 9 verses. And then that story is all over, not to be referred to again. And we go on. Verse 10 of chapter 11 says, these are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begat somebody I can't pronounce, and 2 years after the flood, and on and on and on. And we're back into the genealogy. So right here in the middle, just ka-chung, comes this funny little story that reads this way. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. Down to verse 4. And they said, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto the heavens. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Now you know the story, right? And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one. That's kind of funny English, isn't it? And they have all one language. And this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Let us go down. Again, the divine plural. Let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore the name of it is called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. That's really a story about language, isn't it? And about communication, if you will. Stopping what was going on doesn't seem to have been very difficult for the Lord, and he knew precisely how to do it. Here were a bunch of people getting together, all able to communicate with each other to do a big job. All he had to do to stop them, just stop them right dead in their tracks, was fix them so they couldn't understand each other. When you look at something, on our way here, we were coming through the Rockies, and in Colorado they were building a road right there. You know, it's a tremendously big project. All the way from the girls, the pretty girls who hold the signs. In Colorado, they're girls, by the way. Pretty girls who hold the signs that say, go slow. The sign still says, flag men ahead, but don't let that deceive you. There are pretty girls holding those signs. But all the way from that person who does that to the guy who's driving these huge bulldozers and huge earth-moving machines, all the way to the kid who's rappelling off the side on a rope with a shovel in one hand, knocking the rocks out so they don't fall on your car later on, to the people who are driving these huge machines, and there's some guy peering through a transit, and just a tremendous undertaking. You go past a little farther on and you see where they have all their equipment and materials stockpiled, and there's a huge amount of stuff. Unbelievable. And then just imagine what kind of communication network it takes to make all that work, so that when the guy's picking the rocks off, he's not dropping them onto the head of the guy who's peering through the transit, who happens to be looking the other way at the time at one of the pretty girls who's waving the traffic through. Just to keep that whole thing coordinated and to have it come off requires fantastic communication. And the next time you look at one of those highways and you see how it winds through and how the curves are all banked just right and the pavement's smooth and the view is grand and glorious, I'd like you to think, wow, people did that. Isn't that wonderful? How did they ever manage to pull it off? I have a friend who's a psychoanalyst, and he said to me that every time he sees a 707 take off, he just has to stand there in total amazement, because people built that thing, put it together, put the gasoline in it, figured out how to fly it, and now they got it off with a whole load of people in it, because it takes such tremendous coordination and communication. And all it would take to mess that whole operation up, any one of those, the road building, the airplane, what have you, would be to confound the communication a little bit. For God to stop the building of the Tower of Babel was easy. All he had to do was mix up the communication, and that's something we fight against much of the time. That mixed up communication, because that's the way it has stayed. A major effort in building a road or getting an airplane into the air is the communication involved. Our family life is frequently proof of that as well, isn't it? That communication easily gets mixed up. Jeanette and I had a mini Tower of Babel experience just the other day. It was very, very frustrating. You know what it feels like. Both of us were trying very, very hard to get across to the other one, but it wouldn't work. Feelings were rising, tempers were rising, voices were rising, and finally people were rising and stomping out of the room. No doubt most of you have had some Tower of Babel experiences in your family. That's where we want to get today. Talking about those kinds of experiences in a family and communicating in a family, learning how to avoid the Tower of Babel. Before we get, however, to communication within the family, we need to step off the trail for a bit and look at communication in general. So what I'm going to be talking about for the next little bit is communication in a very, very general sense. You could apply this anywhere in town. Principle one. As long as you are alive, you are communicating. You don't decide when you're going to communicate and when you're not going to communicate. You communicate all the time. Those of you who are all sitting out there now listening to me might think I'm communicating and you're not. But you ought to be here, and then you would know that you are communicating too. I'm not always sure what you're communicating. You're probably not always sure what I'm communicating, but communication goes on all the time. We communicate by gesture, by facial expression, by movement. The mimes last night in the service communicated very, very well, and all kinds of things, didn't they? By gesture and movement and facial expression. Just how you do something can communicate how you feel. My son Ben and I worked together building a cabin a couple years ago, and I think forever Ben will know by the way I saw a board if I'm angry or not. Because it sounds different to him. It sounds different to me too. Probably would to you as well. So we communicate. We don't decide to communicate or not. We communicate. That's part of what we are. Sometimes we communicate clearly, sometimes not. There are times when we can decide to be very careful about how clearly we communicate. And that's part of what we want to talk about. Now, we're into the how of communication. Communication between human beings operates like a cycle. It's got two parts that you know about because you think about them all the time. Sending and receiving. Most people think that's all there is to it because that's the part they see the most, sending and receiving. Sending a message, receiving a message. Some things can go wrong with this part of it. This is the outside part. The part you can see, sending and receiving. If I send an unclear message, if I say, all heretics are wrong. And you say, what? And I say, hard of hearing. I got you, didn't I? I have decided to communicate unclearly. If I communicate in a language you don't understand, then my sending could be the problem in communication. Or if you're upstairs with the stereo on, playing something pretty heavy and noisy, Beethoven or somebody like that, at full blast. You don't play Beethoven at a full blast? Okay. And I'm down in the basement with the washing machine running, and a dryer, and a skill saw, and you're trying to tell me it's time to eat supper, I might not hear you because of interference, huh? The sending and receiving is what would be wrong. You might be yelling very loudly in perfectly good English, which is my language, but I wouldn't get it because it got interfered with. On the receiving end, it's very possible, as every churchgoer knows, to tune out what's going on, and to not pay attention, to not hear. They sometimes cast aspersions on people who wear hearing aids and say at times they just turn them off when they don't want to hear. They hear only what they want to hear. If somebody's telling them something they want to hear, they hear that perfectly well. If somebody's telling them it's time to go to bed or clean up their room or whatever, somehow that never gets in. It's not paying attention. So those kind of problems can occur in sending and receiving. And so far what I've talked about in terms of the communication cycle is stuff you all know, right? Now maybe we get a bit beyond that. There are three more steps, the inside steps, to the communication cycle. The first one is interpreting. That happens inside. That's when I take the message that you have sent and that I have received now, and that might be two different ones, right? And now I squeeze from it whatever meaning there is for me. I put together what meaning it has for me. I decide what it's going to mean for me. Then, depending on how I interpret what you have sent and that what I have received, comes the next stage, which is my feeling. I don't determine really an awful lot how I'm going to feel about it. Depending on how I interpret it, my feelings are not very negotiable. They're going to be there. I might make an error here that would cause me to have an error here. I'll give you an example in a minute. After I've done my feeling, comes the next step in communication, that is my intending. What I'm going to do to you. That again is based on my feeling. And my intending then determines what I send. And we're back outside. These three here are inside. Nobody sees those directly. I'm the expert on what goes on inside me. Nobody else can be. Now, an example. Let's say that the scene is dinner table, and we've just sat down, and we've set our table grace, and we're beginning to eat. And I say the sentence, I'm going to try very hard not to inflect it in any way. I say the sentence, this is really great soup. Okay? That's the objective sentence. If we had a script of what's going on there, that's what I have said. Those are the words that I have said. Now, I'm sending, huh? People around the room are going to hear that. People sitting at the table, they can look at my face, they can get the whole message as much as I'm sending, and it might mean a whole bunch of different things. If Jeanette and I have had a sort of tense time right before lunch, I might be trying to be friends, huh? I might be saying, you know, let's forget about that and forget about the dent you put in the fender and or whatever, and you know, let's get on to be friends. This is, and what I'm saying is, this soup is really great. And if she hears me that way, if she interprets me as wanting to be friends, her feeling would be probably relief. Huh? I like that. Let's be friends again. I'd rather have it that way than the other way. And her intending then would be to come back at me with something that would clearly indicate her reception of the notion of being friends. She might say, thank you, and wiggle, kind of. Might she? No? What might she do? Yeah, she did. Then we got the cycle complete. But that could go wrong in a whole bunch of places. Inside. If we had had an unpleasantness before lunch, and I said, this is really great soup, and she thought I was wanting to continue the fight, I was telling her she was a bum cook and didn't really care enough about what went on in the kitchen to try to keep her old man happy. That would be her interpretation. Her feeling would be one of being put down again, one of anger, maybe wanting to retaliate. And how might she then respond? She might say, well, if you don't like it, you can leave. Huh? Or she might say, fix your own soup, which you just did. Or she might say, well, thank you. If you had a typescript of those two, it might read all right, huh? This is really great soup. Well, thank you. And you'd think everything's fine at this house, unless you'd heard the inflections and had some idea thereby of what was going on inside. Where a lot of marital conversations, and I think also other interfamily conversations, parent-child conversations, go awry is on this one here. We like to be experts on what the other guy is trying to do to us. We like that. We're sort of natural at that, you know. We think we can read the other person very well. I think we always know what they're thinking. If you can remember as a rule, just a very simple, basic rule of communication, the other guy's got to be the expert on what goes on inside him. We interpret the other person's intention, and it makes all the difference in the world. Now, here's the rule then for communicating very clearly when it gets difficult, when communication gets sticky. Principle two comes into play. When two people who know each other rather well and usually communicate rather well have difficulty communicating, chances are where the problem is inside, right there. That's where the problem's coming from. What do they usually do, however? They don't pay attention to the inside part. They do just the opposite. They pay attention to the outside part. Their speech gets slow and loud and clear and distinct, which begins to sound like you're talking to an idiot. Sometimes they turn to a dictionary for definition of terms to be very precise with Mr. Webster. They're looking in the wrong place, aren't they? They're looking outside. Most likely the problem is inside. This was our problem the other day, wasn't it? We were getting loud and slow and distinct with each other. The problem was not there. The problem was inside, in terms of feelings, in terms of interpreting each other, in terms of what the other was intending to do. So, a rule. Bring the inside three outside, because that's possible to do. There are three kinds of sentences. They all begin with I. Say what you understand. You're talking about how you're interpreting the other person. Say, I think. These are I think sentences generally. Say what you feel. I feel. I feel like you're putting me down. I feel like you're crowding me. I feel like you're not appreciating me. You know, whatever. And say what you want, what you're intending. What I want is. Simple, isn't it? Really simple. Hard to do when you're on the spot, because very often what you think and what you feel and what you want are things you're not terribly ready to share, certainly not in the midst of a battle. But sharing them can turn that battle all the way around. So, principle two is an important one, I think. When two people who usually communicate okay are having difficulty, chances are the problem's not on the outside, but it's on the inside. Now, we want to look at what we communicate. Basically, people communicate three different kinds of things, three different contents, if you will. They communicate information to each other. It doesn't take two human beings to communicate information. One computer can communicate information to another computer. Information that the operator would never need to see. The operator might need to see a result of that, right? But it doesn't take human beings to communicate information. We do a lot of that because we have to. Probably the greatest example I can think of a place where information gets communicated is engineering school. Because we're talking about objective things all the time, aren't we? Out there, things that are measurable and can be weighed and all sorts of things. And that's what's important in engineering school. Communicating information. The second category of things that people communicate is control. Again, you don't need people to communicate control. A stop sign communicates control to me. How about to you? A red light. but looks, you know, from 3/4 mile away like a radar car, Smokey, beside the road, will communicate all kinds of control to me. It doesn't take people to communicate control, but we do a lot of that. Parenting involves a lot of communicating of control to children. Doesn't it, parents? Doesn't it, children? There's a trick involved sometimes, something you got to watch out for with just these two categories. Sometimes one gets disguised as the other. Listen to this sentence and you'll know exactly what I mean. This is, of course, a simple bit of information. All good children brush their teeth before they go to bed at night. If that's said to my son, that is not information, is it? That's a message, get in there and brush your teeth. That's control. Or we'll take one that that might happen between two adults. All right-thinking people vote Democratic. That's simple information, isn't it, for us Democrats? But there might be a Republican in the room who would think differently. That's control. You get in trouble when you begin masking control statements as though they were just information statements. People don't like that. It causes friction. But so far, we've been talking about really two brands, two contents that get communicated between people that don't require humans. They are what we would call instrumental communication. They help get the job done. That's important. But then we get to the third kind of human communication, and this is kind for humans only. It is a humanizing kind of communication, and it has to do with feelings. Only people can do this. You can't do this with a computer. You can't do this with a stop sign. You can do it via an intermediary. When I read this book, I learn about feelings that people had, don't I? And sometimes St. Luke communicates to me feelings. Even though I've not met him, I've read his stuff. And his feelings come through to me and resonate on mine. There's a couple different ways in which we communicate feelings that are important. One is just to express them. Ventilate is the word. When you say whoopee or yuck or something like that, or oh fudge or shoot or whatever it is you say when something goes wrong, you are expressing your feeling, aren't you? It helps if there's somebody else there to hear that. It helps make you feel more human. Where you really notice that is when you have feelings that are very strong and very negative, like a feeling of sadness or grief or loss. And if you can express that and have another human being, just have another human being be there and hear you do that. That can be very important. There are times when our feelings are complicated in ways that make them difficult for us to understand. And one of the better ways to begin to understand our own feelings when that's happening is to have another human being there to talk to who can resonate with us. I call that an empathic conversation, where one person is trying to express feelings and the other person is trying to understand and feel with, which is what empathic means, feel with. What's required for a genuine empathic conversation is a rather high degree of trust and openness with the other person. What gets established here, finally, is a genuinely, uniquely human relationship, one that can only take place between two human beings. Martin Buber called it an I-thou relationship. If you read him the way I do, what he seems to be talking about is that this is how we make persons out of one another. This is how it happens. The devotion this morning after breakfast was talking about that a bit. The personing, peopling of each other. I use a different word. I use the word bonding. This establishes a bond between two human beings. An empathic conversation. How we are able to exchange feelings with another human being. I'd like you to take a stab at it now. How are we doing on the time? Fine. And spend about the next few minutes in a conversation with somebody near you. It doesn't have to be somebody you know well. It might be easier that way, but it might be more fun the other way. So you decide. Pick a partner. Will you do that? And what I'm going to have you do is have two brief conversations, one in which I want you to talk about what makes you happy, anything, and another in which you talk about what makes you afraid. Again, anything. You pick it. Understand what I want?
You're each going to do that?
Yeah, I'd like you each to do that. Pick a partner, somebody next to you. Get up and run across the room if you feel like it. And then you change sides. And the one who's been receiver now becomes sender and talks about the same thing. Okay, got it?
Call you a listener.
And this sentence is, something I'm afraid of is, but now just a little extra instruction goes with this one. Because there's a strong temptation when people talk about things they're afraid of for us to talk them out of it. For us to, quote, help. Or to give advice, or to give suggestions. And I'm wanting you to avoid that impulse if you can. Restrain yourselves, dears. Just try to understand and feel with your partner as he or she expresses his or her fear to you. All right? Go. Were you able to establish an empathic relationship? Did it work? No? Yes? Who thinks it worked? A few? Okay. All right. Good. Good. When it comes to things that bond people to each other, a sharing of feelings, according to the style that you were just trying to do it, is one of the strongest ones I know of, to bond two people together. I had a kind of curious experience with that. Several summers ago, I was teaching summer school, and I frequently would begin the session, you know, first day, first crack out of the box, by having people pair off into teams, and then running them through a conversation like this for like 20, 25 minutes. During which they start with the sort of stuff that's on your driver's license, that kind of information exchange, and then move to positive feeling exchange, like things that make me happy, you know, the greatest thing I did last year, that sort of stuff, and then move to negative feelings, things that make me afraid, the one you were dealing with, the biggest goof last year, on and on, negative things, and then move to category four, which was interactive things, how I feel about you right now, you know, what I'd like you to change, what I'd like to do with you this afternoon if we had the time, that sort of thing. Happened there was an odd number of people in the class, which meant I had to participate. I usually steer away from that because I can't keep time that well when I participate. But I was participating and, you know, sitting this far away from a young minister with a red beard and rimless glasses. And really concentrating on him and sharing my stuff with him, and he was sharing his stuff with me. I'd never seen him before in my life. I really didn't exchange much with him personally for the rest of that summer session. He was at a party at my house, and we talked a little bit then, but that was, you know, kind of in passing. What we had shared during this 25 minutes of structured conversation was the kind of information that it takes you years to share in a normal friendship, you know? How many people do you talk to about things you're afraid of? Not very many, right? So, end of scene one. I didn't see this guy again for a couple of years. Then one morning, I was in the sacristy at Bethel Church in St. Louis, and the door came open, and this face with the red beard and the rimless glasses walked through. And my immediate reaction was, oh my goodness, here's my old buddy. But I couldn't call his name, and I couldn't remember where I'd seen him. I knew all kinds of things about him. I had a strong feeling of friendship with him, but all the rest of it was missing. Well, we got it together finally, you know, but that's what happens when we exchange things. We call it friendship, I call it bonding. I think if a married couple can have this, if parents and children can have this, can exchange feelings in an open and honest way. It's not always easy to do in a family, because often in a family there's lots of political things going on at the same time. Huh? There are power struggles. There are struggles over the family goods and what have you. And it's risky at times to be wide open about your feelings, to open up completely. It's a bit dangerous, but it really bonds people together. There are some other things that bond people together. We'll talk about those later on. But I'm glad for you if you had the experience of a bit of empathy. It's great stuff. Now, let me point out some four bummers in family communication. When I do family therapy or do marital therapy, I see these four, the terrible four, appearing again, again, again. These are things to avoid, if possible. Number one, biggie on the list, is sarcasm. Sarcasm is really bad communication. It's not just nasty communication, it is ineffective communication. It doesn't work well. I should know, I'm great at it. The problem with sarcasm is, one, it is indirect, and two, there's no good defense for it. If I'm sarcastic to you, you know I'm displeased, but you might not be very sure at what I'm displeased. You know I'm unhappy, you know it's with you, but you don't know what you got to do to change it, because I'm not telling you that, right? It also leaves you in a sort of defenseless position, because if you can't change it, if you don't know really what I want, what can you do except sit there and sweat? Or bleed, or whatever. So, number one bummer is sarcasm. Number two bummer is pretty much like it, and it is ridicule. There are some families in which the controlling from parent to child goes on largely via ridicule. I think this is very destructive. It's like sarcasm in that it leaves you very little room to maneuver. No way you can get out from under it. When you see a family in which there is a lot of ridicule going on, these are the people who use ridicule in the rest of their relationships too, whenever possible. A third bummer in family communication is low approval, constant scowl, you know, the parental scowl. I have a little thing I say about German parents. It might be true of other Northern Europeans. German parents seem to believe that if they ever fully approve of anything their children do, their children will never do another thing right in their life. Right, parents? You know, you never say, wow, that's a great job. However, that's what you say, right? Well, it's a pretty good job. Now, if you would just fix it up a little bit over here and, you know, next time do it a little, and then, huh? It's what Eric Byrne very aptly calls a gold stamp with a brown edge, if you like his language. That's what it is. Low approval, never full approval. no matter what sort of ability level we're operating with, we always try to give them a little jab to make them try harder the next time, right? I think that's a negative way to communicate within a family. The fourth bummer, is blaming and scapegoating in a family. We tend to be, you know, something I believe very deeply about human beings is we got a moral streak in us, huh? Think about the conversation that goes on inside you much of the time, particularly if you're a little bit down. The conversation that goes on inside you, I think, is like the one that goes on inside me, and it is self-justifying, isn't it? I am right, you know, I am doing it the best I can. Everybody ought to know that. And when I'm attacked, what do? I don't say, yeah, you got me. You're right, I'm a bum. I don't say that. I blame somebody else. Huh? Usually you, right? I blame somebody else. This can get going in a family. I've had marriage couples in marriage counseling who were very ready to spend, you know, all kinds of money to come to me to try to convince me that the other guy was wrong. Yeah, that's what they'd spend all hour doing until I point out to them this is a kind of expensive way to justify yourself. You know, you could probably be doing something better here than that. But blaming, okay, that's a bad business. If you find a lot of that going on, it's worth looking under the rock and seeing what's there. What we've talked about so far today with the communication cycle and the stuff that gets communicated, and finally, the major function of human communication within the family is this bonding business by the empathic conversation. That'll get you through most things. However, things do get sticky sometimes when what people need or want is at cross purposes with what somebody else needs or wants. When change is sudden or misunderstood or resented within a family. Then you probably need to communicate extra carefully. There are some very simple ways to do that. If you're aware of, you know, huge, humongous problem arising in a family, that's a time to then focus in on how you're communicating. Be careful at it. Structure it. Set it up like a labor negotiation, okay? Call it a negotiation if you want. What's happened is, in a family, the basic covenant is still there. We got to change the contract, and contracts are changeable, right? And you do that via a negotiation. And you arrange for it, just as you would for a labor negotiation. Not everybody's going to be there, just the principals. Where it takes place needs probably to be a private place. When, that needs to coincide with everybody's schedule, who's going to be involved. It needs to take place at a time when nobody's all bagged out, fatigued, and it needs to take place at a time when nobody's intoxicated. It needs to take place at a time when nobody's wrought up emotionally to begin with. Then, we define in advance what it is we're going to talk about. Whatever. How often the kids can have the car, or how late they can stay out, or where we're going for vacation. Probably also need to determine how long this conversation is going to go on. This is a big mistake a lot of people make when they try to discuss something that's very important and emotionally loaded for them. They try to do a marathon number on it. You know, we're going to fight until it's over and somebody wins and it's settled and we don't have to mess around with it anymore. That doesn't work very well. You probably can go at that kind of conversation only for 20 minutes. And then you ought to quit because it starts unraveling on you. People come apart. One last thing you need before entering into this kind of conversation is a good parachute, a way to bail out before the time arrives if necessary. The best one I know is a little sentence. We aren't getting anywhere. That's the ripcord. Out you go. agreed upon in advance, ahead of time. You see what I'm doing when I say, we aren't getting anywhere. I'm sharing it, am I not? If I'm saying, you know, you're so stupid, we can't talk anymore, or you're such a pig-headed fool, I can't get through to you anymore, what am I doing then? Right? But if we got a good bailout line, and we agree, once somebody pulls that ripcord, we quit. And then we renegotiate another negotiation session. Maybe not right then, maybe later on. But we'll need to get at this again. It sounds terribly formal and tight. Maybe it doesn't need to be all that formal and tight. Maybe it does. Maybe it does. If you really get in a jam, and this doesn't work, you know, if you try structuring carefully a conversation within a family, and if that doesn't work, after several tries, and you're really not getting anywhere, then is maybe the time to pull in a professional who will help you communicate around the difficulties you're having. The other thing to pay close attention to when communication is very difficult is the inside part of the communication cycle. Okay, I've shot all my time. Anybody got anything you want to say to me? I'm ready. Back there, please.
I kind of object to, you said this person you felt close to, but you couldn't remember his name.
Yeah.
Doesn't it have to be kind of a basis of trust before you can share some of these things?
No, no, I don't think so. Well, you're not understanding what I did. What I did was alter the usual social rules about exchange. I took that on myself as teacher in this class, just as I did in here, you know. Most of you were talking to people you knew, I think. If I had asked you to find somebody you don't know at all and then share that kind of stuff, I would have been altering the basic social rules.
I talked to somebody that I didn't know. That's right.
Okay. There are some social rules that we abide by, unless some fruitcake like me comes along and says, let's change them. I didn't really say that, I just pulled it, didn't I? That's what I did in the class, too. The fact that comes through to me is, it's not that I have to know somebody for 10 years to have those kinds of feelings about them. It's that I have to share that kind of stuff back and forth with a person. That's what develops the feeling. Dig it? You're not sure? Think about it. Let me hear from you again. Anything else? Please.
Your parachute, if we're just not getting anywhere, I think a lot of it depends upon the tone of voice and how it's said. Isn't it before you can really bail out? Because you can bail out, use that sentence and leave the other party right up in the air. If I were to say to you, well, we're just not getting anywhere, that means, well, you know, I can't get anywhere with you. I think that's putting you down. I mean, I think that's as much as saying, well, I just can't talk with you because
I'm such an idiot.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. If you and I had agreed in advance that that was going to be our parachute sentence, then I think I'd probably hear it differently. I'd probably be ready to agree with you, too.
No matter what tone of voice I use.
Yeah. I might object to your tone of voice. Say, okay, we're bailing out, but I don't like your tone of voice, lady.
Then I tell you, you have to have the last word, huh?
And I'd say, right on.
Touché.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Except without the laughter following it, with
right.
Stomping sounds and horse sounds and that sort of thing. Please.
Lots of times you don't have the chance to agree on something beforehand. You know, problems come up just out of the blue, and you're not expecting to have to go through that process. I'm just wondering if this is just something that develops over time in a friendship or a relationship, that after one experience or
At times there are immense time pressures on a decision, for example, and that can really cob things up. You know, the most efficient government is a dictatorship, right? If you want to really get things done, that's what you got to have. And if you have a lot of time pressure, that's how it's going to end up. Somebody grabs and says, "Yeah, we're doing it this way." If nobody knocks him over, that's the way it goes, or her over. yeah, the model that I'm suggesting doesn't take into account a lot of time pressure, which sometimes is there. Very often there is time to make these kinds of decisions that families need to make and get stuck on.
What will probably happen is that you'll have a few of these encounter sessions first, you know, where the problem is hit. You know, and then you realize that this has happened a couple times and maybe you need to sit down and talk about
mm-hmm.
it. Now, maybe here in a relationship with somebody that lives in the same lodge or something, you might be able to do that if you're living there for, you know, 3 months or something, then it'd be worth trying to look at it.
You begin here, you were talking about like building an airplane or building a road. When you have a group of people, whether it's a group of workers or within a family, there's also, like in building a road, a structure
mm-hmm.
that you have to have within the working group to facilitate the movement to go towards a goal, even if you don't have complete agreement mm-hmm. between the different levels of structure. Like oftentimes the foreman of a job could want someone to do something and he wouldn't necessarily have to agree with it, but because of the structure within the group to facilitate the movement towards the goal. Like lots of times I know the workers on the job call the engineer an idiot for doing it this way, they should have done it that way, you know. And everybody has their ideas because of the structure within the group that are working on the project, the workers automatically do, even though they have some second thoughts about what they're doing being the best for the project. And this is the same way within a family, of course, too,
mm-hmm.
That you're working towards certain goals within it. And it's best if you can, like you say, communicate so that everybody knows the reason why the engineer set it up this way. If the workers underneath know why he's doing it this way, then they probably will say, well, yeah, it's, you know, a reasonable idea. But if he don't tell them nothing, chances are they might be disgruntled and not understand what his end plan is.
And you bring up something that's really very important that we'll get to the next time we're working together here on this stuff, and that is the structure in a family changes, I think, just radically as the children grow.
Oh, sure it does.
Yeah.
Responsibilities,
and
that part of the thing.
Right, that kind of change, which isn't always clear to everybody, you know, we don't agree about it. We agree that it happens, but we don't agree at what sort of timetable it happens. Example, should 16-year-olds be allowed to determine how long they stay out at night? Should that be their choice? They come home when they please. Or lots of 16-year-olds think that. A lot of parents of 16-year-olds don't, right? That's a point of where the structure is changing and we're not agreeing on where it is.
This is right. Like a 3-year-old kid that wants to push the lawnmower, and then when he gets old enough to push it, then you don't want it anymore.
You got kids like that too? Okay. Well, I think we probably ought to quit.
Hey, Paul, a couple things you ought to...
Thank you, Paul.